This is KBLULP in Logan. My name is Richard Arlen Blake, and I'd like to welcome you all back to the next episode of Baladish Anish Folklore Now. On this episode, there are a couple of things that I want to discuss, but first, what I'd like to begin with is by reminding everybody about July 20th, and that being the 50th anniversary of Neil Armstrong's walking on the moon. That is a very significant event within human history, and there are so many fascinating things about it, among which, of course, are several conspiracy theories and a bunch of strange ideas people have about Armstrong walking on the moon and whether or not it really happened and everything. But I'm not going to delve into that right now. When I was teaching one of my classes, there was a student who was following along with the conspiracy theories about, oh, what about this? You know, it looks like this flag is kind of blowing in the wind. It's like, well, there is no wind on the moon. How the heck is that happening? Of course, the answer to that is the flag unfurled, and that's where how it unfurled. And it stopped there, because if you check photos all around it, you'll notice that that flag hasn't moved at all. So just milestones in our history as human beings, the accomplishments that we have done definitely need a shout out here and there when they come along, because we don't always appreciate just how spectacular and significant it was when that particular event happened. And a couple of episodes ago, we talked about folk music, and I gave you three examples of songs that were analyzed using what I called a folk dissection, using Wikipedia as a source for that. I also said that there was a fourth song that I would like to talk about, but I didn't have the time, and I would have discussed it last time, but I didn't have the time then either. So today, I felt that I would open the show by playing that song for you and then maybe doing another folk dissection, because this is a song that I really like. So the song is called Loch Lomond, or The Bonnie Banks of Loch Lomond. Bonnie is a Scots word that means beautiful, and I mentioned that in another podcast that I talked about the Scots language. And there are quite a few versions of this song. The first time that I encountered it was on an episode of Looney Tunes, where you have two characters who are walking in a direction, and one of them takes a high road, another one takes a low road, and they're singing the most famous lines of the song, "You take the high road, and I'll take the low road, and I'll be in Scotland before you." And then it cuts off and gets interrupted because there's someone in the imaginary audience who is disruptive and stops them from singing, and then it goes to another scene. Another place that I came across that line was actually on a Tiny Toons segment. Tiny Toons is it's just another thing that's put out there by Warner Brothers in the Looney Tunes genre, where Plucky Duck is handed some bagpipes, and he plays these pipes while he's singing the song with the lines, "You take the high road and I'll take the low road," doing so with a kind of fake Scottish accent. How he does that, I have no idea, as he's singing and playing the bagpipes at the same time, doing the, "You take the high road and I'll take the low road." You know, I do terrible with Scottish accents as well. It takes a bit of practice, and usually I have to be trying to speak Gaelic in order to bring it out. But those are the two places where I came across it first, and I had no idea where that particular song came from until I went looking for it, and then I suddenly found it, and I thought, oh, it's not called You Take the High Road. It's actually called The Bonnie Banks of Loch Lomond, or Loch Lomond. Bonnie is a Scots word that means beautiful. It's used a lot when it's dealing with scenery or with titles, and so you'll come across the word Bonnie a lot in the Scots language. The version that I'm going to play for you is by Ella Roberts, and that's probably my favorite version. The story behind this song involves the Second Jacobite Rising that took place in 1745, where the supporters of Bonnie Prince Charlie, there's that word Bonnie again, attempting to return the Stuarts back to the throne of England and Scotland. His father, James II of England, who was also King James VII of Scotland, had been ousted by the people who feared that his Catholicism would lead to an attempt to restore Catholicism as the state religion of England and Britain in general. The story here is the Bonnie Prince Charlie is defeated, and a bunch of Scots are captured by the supporters of the Williamite government, by the Protestant government people who definitely don't want anything to do with these people. They're taken to London, where they're put on trial, and of course it's a show trial, but a bunch of the relatives of these people who have been condemned go there to see their family members. They're there, they see their family members die, and then, of course, after the trial, London is a good distance from Scotland, and so they're walking back from London to Loch Lomond, as this song indicates, in one particular person. What essentially it's saying is, you take the high road, meaning your the dead relative who's being carried in a carriage is being taken on a higher road over to Scotland where they're to be buried. And I'll take the low road. I'm going to be walking on the road all the way to Scotland, a long walk distance. Basically, the singer is a living person, pretty much indicating, I will see you in Loch Lomond, and you can kind of read into that what you want. But that's not quite what you think of probably when you hear this song, but that is the story behind the song. When I first heard the song, I thought they were talking about a couple of lovers going and meeting somewhere. You go this way and I'll go that way and I'll be there before you or whatever. Of course, if you actually listen to the words word for word, it's a little, you can tell there's a sad element to it. And so I had to actually read the song. We don't always read the words of a song. We listen to it and like the song. We kind of pick it up later, the word. Basically, you know, I'm going to play this song and then I'm going to do another folk dissection for you. But this song, I just couldn't go without talking about because it is really culturally significant, and I wanted to make sure that you knew the story behind it before I played this.
Thank you.
So what did you think of that song? Did the story that I told you line up with what the impression that you get from listening to that song? Sometimes those things, they can be well attuned to get you the right message out of what they're singing about. But other times, they doesn't exactly happen that way. You have to have it explained to you. One other thing I guess I should point out to you is that Bonnie Prince Charlie is a big hero in some areas when it comes to nationalism, where people are fighting against the English. The Irish had Bonnie Prince Charlie as a potential hero that will save them from the evil English Protestants, you know, save their Catholicism and everything from the British, the English. And so we listen to these songs, and the impressions that we get are mixed. I've talked to a few people who had different ideas about what it is that they are actually singing about. And there are some pretty interesting ones. The most common misconception a lot of people have is that it's about a couple of lovers who are going to meet at Loch Lomond. But of course, that's not the case. Unless, of course, they're there to meet the ghost of that lover. And I would have to go and look through a few other places to find out all the different ideas that people have had. But I'm not going to go into that right now. The purpose here is to do my folk dissection. I just feel that this song is really culturally significant, and therefore I felt that I should bring that in as an element of folk music. So if we go over here onto the characteristics chart on Wikipedia, we have, was it transmitted through an oral tradition? This song is pretty old. It dates back to the 1800s. Or the 18th century, sorry, not the 1800s. It's been passed on and on and on. I mean, it's been through oral tradition from one person to another for a long time. As I pointed out to you before, Looney Tunes picked it up and threw it in a couple times. So it definitely falls into it being passed on through oral tradition. Then the music was often related to national culture. Like I said, this deals with a Scottish rebellion. It is Scottish culture, Scottish nationalism, and Catholic culture as well. So it certainly is music that is related to national culture. See, they commemorate historical and personal events. Okay, Jacobite rebellion, that is put down, and these people are brought to London to be executed. So it is a historical event. And then the song has been performed by custom over a long period of time. Like I said, a couple centuries old, so it certainly has been performed that many times. And so this is a folk song. Of all the songs that I've dissected for you, only one of them wasn't a folk song. I don't know if I'll be doing any other folk dissections in the future, but I just wanted to do this one because I thought it would be fun to do that. The next thing that I want to bring up is a lot of people, I guess, who don't understand exactly what folklore is might misconstrue a few things as folklore that might not be, but are similar. As we've said plenty of times, as I have said plenty of times, folklore is informal traditional culture. It is basically the traditions of the folk. They originate with the folk and rise up from the folk. But does it always have to be bottom up? Can folklore be top down? And the answer to that, just offhand, would be no, that's impossible. But a lot of times when you have government or public officials trying to go out and create things, to bring things out that they think are important, or they want to create some new tradition, that is coming from the top down, right? So they might be collecting a lot of different cultural events or a bunch of literature, poetry, kind of like the Cowboy Poetry Festival in Elko, Nevada. That is folklore, correct? That it's run out of the Folk Life Center there. And these people are coming together, and most of them, of course, are singing. And therefore, that's an element of folklore, but that is top down because they created the situation for these people to come. However, what these people brought with them is theirs, and therefore you can say it's bottom up rather than top down. Some things that people try and bring that are top down, they want to create or they want to reinvent something that hasn't been around for a long time. This kind of gets you on a little iffy scale, but when we're talking about this, we have to ask, okay, this government agency wants to go and create this particular event. They want to make this a tradition. They want to continue this on. And what if, you know, this happens, people are getting together. Is this now a folk tradition that the government brought in to pretty much harmonize with everything? A lot of times the government has probably borrowed this from someone else where it was bottom up. And so you could say, well, it's bottom up anyway, but it's not bottom up where this particular cultural event is being performed. There are a lot of Scottish festivals and Irish music festivals and these agencies that bring them about. In a lot of places, we have people of Scottish and Irish ancestry. Then we have people who create new things and they kind of throw them out there, like they create a video game. Someone creates a video game. This is one of those big examples. Someone creates this video game and it's really popular. All these people love it and everyone's playing it and doing their own thing with it. Okay, is that folklore? No, because this is something that someone just threw out there and a bunch of people picked it up, but it leads to traditions breaking off of it. What do you call it then when something is kind of cultural, it's brought in there by one person and then it's picked up by a bunch of people and then it's broken off? What the folklorists have decided to do with this is call it folklore-esque. And so folklore-esque essentially is where things can come out like Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit. People can take these things that in a way they do look like they're culturally significant, but they're not informal traditional culture in and of themselves. It's what breaks off of them that becomes informal traditional culture. And therefore, that is folklore. That is folk tradition. People get together into J.R.R. Tolkien clubs. People get into science fiction writing clubs. These organizations, these groups, these are folk groups that came about because of Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings is not folklore. Lord of the Rings is folklore-esque in how it connects and becomes a folk tradition. There's other things that can be said about it, but I think I'd mostly be repeating myself with this topic. And I just want everyone to realize that sometimes things are not necessarily folklore, even though other people may be trying to make it look that way. It doesn't mean it's not interesting or that it's not significant. It's just not folklore. Now that I've talked about the Bonnie Banks of Loch Lomond and about folklore-esque and how traditions may be top-down or bottom-up, I want to go back into an astronomical area. Maybe I should have gone into this right after I talked about Neil Armstrong landing on the moon, since this is also dealing with the moon, but I guess this is as good a place as any to bring this up again. On NASA's website, there is a place where you can find a bunch of pictures of the day that NASA puts out there. When I look onto that website, there are a whole slew of really awesome, interesting photos. You have pictures of the planets, you have pictures of the moon, you have pictures of huge gas clouds like the Pillars of Creation that are visible through the telescopes where they take pictures. A lot of the names that they give these, of course, imply Christian or Greek and Latin mythologies and legends to explain them in a way that kind of makes it more interesting. And one particular thing that caught my eye recently was the picture of something called a strawberry moon that was rising up behind the Temple of Poseidon in Sonion in Greece. Whenever you look at ancient Greek architecture, even though it's run down over the years or a lot of it's collapsed, it still brings out a lot of imagination. But when you see this strawberry moon in this particular situation, you are reminded that another element of folklore is myths. Mythologists and a lot of people who are in the history area tend to want to keep myth to themselves and talk about it as something of cultural significance that, you know, passes down, that historians will talk about. But mythologists don't always consider what they do as folklore. Maybe the attitude has changed, I am not sure. Poseidon is the god of the sea, the Greek god of the sea. And this particular temple is sitting near, pretty much near the coast. And so when you see Luna going up over the horizon here, you're reminded that nature itself brings out a lot of mythological ideas, a lot of traditions. Many events like the Olympics with the Greeks pretty much originated as a celebration of the gods, or out of respect for the gods, fear of the gods, saying, oh, please don't hurt us. Let us give these sacrifices to the gods so that they don't harm us in the future, or maybe they'll give us some benefits if we do that. The gods, some of them are seen as benign. Some of them look like they are coming out to stand for justice, like the goddess Artemis, the goddess Athena. They tend to be depicted as being goddesses of justice or of wisdom. They are representative of what is good in society. But a lot of the gods have kind of decadent histories themselves, if you use the Iliad and the Odyssey and other Greek traditions to go back on. And that's why Zeus has so many illegitimate children. He pretty much cheats on his wife on a regular basis. And you can say, well, that's kind of how male society worked back then. You had your wife and then you had all these mistresses or whatever, because you really only settled down with this woman because you need to have children. So the ideas about the gods are mixed. And when the Romans picked up on the Greek gods, they pretty much started to try and make Greek and Roman gods equilateral, like Zeus and Jupiter, or, well, Apollo's the same for both. You have Diana and Artemis. You have Poseidon and Neptune. And people don't always realize that the names of these Roman gods actually predate the interaction with the Greeks. And therefore, many of these Roman gods actually have other traits that are different from their Greek counterparts or their Greek equilaterals. The Romans just loved to incorporate everything Greek into their society, and so they had to do this, I suppose, in order to keep themselves within the Greek tradition. One of the gods is Cronos. So Cronos is technically a Titan. I don't know if you're a Titan, you can't be a god, but he is definitely not one of the Olympian gods, though he is the father of six of the members of the Olympian gods. And basically, Cronos ruled the Titans, ruled over the gods, until one day Zeus was born and ended up killing him. The story is far more complicated than that. I kind of glossed over the fact that Cronos had a prophecy that he was going to be overthrown by one of his children, and therefore every time his wife Rhea had a child, he would swallow the child because he couldn't have this person grow up and overthrow him. And of course, Rhea happened to take Zeus and hide him from the god and replaced him with a stone. And therefore, Cronos swallowed a stone instead of Zeus. But then Zeus came back later. He overthrew his father, threw him out of Mount Olympus. And the other children of Cronos were regurgitated by Cronos by something that Zeus did. Different sources contradict each other on what exactly happened. And so Cronos is seen as an evil upstart, kind of not a demon, because the Greeks didn't understand demons in that way, but he was seen as sort of a lowly, unlikable, undesirable entity to be thinking about. Zeus is the one that you call out to. You do not resort to Cronos for anything. The Romans didn't quite see it that way when they incorporated the Greek gods. The Greeks, of course, saw Cronos as the embodiment of time. How that turned into him being a evil god, I'm not sure, but the Roman equivalent of Kronos is Saturn. So Saturn, of course, is the name of a planet. And whenever we name a planet, we always name it after some Greek mythological character and usually give it the Roman name, but not always. The Romans actually celebrated annually an event called the Saturnalia, where pretty much it was an excuse for people to go and party and celebrate and pretty much binge drink and do gambling and things that are a lot of times frowned upon. These were things that are usually frowned upon on normal days, but on this day you can go and do whatever you want. Sort of the Halloween back then, but of course not quite the same. I don't know if people were necessarily doing pranks on people or anything on those days, but I'll have to look into that. But the celebration was on December 17th through the 23rd. In a sense, that was leading kind of through the solstice, through the time of the winter solstice. I've talked about legends about the winter solstice before, and here is one of those traditions that the Greeks and the Romans were doing, mostly the Romans, as I said. Since this was a time of rebirth, as I said before, with a lot of different things, or where time can alter or reality can shift, as the Romans saw it, there some of these celebrations had people where they would replace roles, like slaves would be at the banquet table instead of the masters, or people would dress up as lords and you'd have commoners going and taking the place of the elites, while the elites would come and play the parts of commoners. And I have no idea if any really high up people, like governors of provinces, did anything about this. The way that you see it when you're reading Roman history is that you don't hear much about these celebrations and these rites that were performed by the people there. You get the impression that a lot of the people that are higher up just kind of frowned upon all of this. They said, well, let those little peasants do what they want. If it makes them happy, that'll keep them from causing any trouble. But this Saturnalia, it has come down to us in other forms through other cultures as well, just those ideas where society stands on its head, where things get thrown around because of the coming, the death of the sun and the rebirth of the sun. As the sun gets higher and higher in the sky, things get back to normal as they saw it. One of the main reasons that I decided to talk about this is there is an interesting trend going on here lately. In the last couple decades, I think there's been a kind of rebellion, for lack of a better term, of a lot of people against what is commonly traditional ideas, traditional norms, whether it's Christianity, Christian faiths, or Jewish faiths. A lot of times, a lot of people are either going agnostic or they are looking back on other ideas or older ideas that people believed in so that they could go and follow the rites of those traditions. The reinvention of the Druids in Britain, where they get together on Stonehenge annually to perform some religious rites there, is one example. But some people I have seen wearing the Ankh, the Egyptian power symbol, and people are praying to Olympian gods, and they're worshiping the Olympian gods like they were real. And it's not up to us to pass judgment on them, but I just found it really interesting that the people are rejecting what there is today, and they're going back to what they see as older and maybe more pure forms of observance, things to admire, things to worship, or things to pretty much hold in high esteem or to respect. This is kind of a similar to the tradition where a lot of people are going to nature in order to find their peace of mind, to find what they're looking for as the meaning of life. And some people are worshipers of nature, in Africa, a lot of those traditions of nature spirits has continued on from who knows how when up until today. And so people, of course, today are thinking about going and looking into those ideas. The rebellion against Christian ideas, I think, has to do with disillusionment with how society is going, and they think that modern day people just don't respect the earth the way they should. And I actually came across someone who had, I don't know if he exactly worships Zeus, but he acts and does research into the sense of modern day ideas, modern day beliefs of Zeus and people that follow Zeus. And he pretty much said that, well, a lot of people, they've kind of replaced a lot of saints and a lot of aspects of the Christian God and made them back into the Greek mythological gods, the Roman gods. And I contend that a lot of the things that have come about in Catholicism, like St. Christopher being the patron saint of travelers and patron saints of one thing or another, it seems to me like what's going on here is they're replacing a Greek god with a saint this or saint that, but then other people are saying, oh, you are being oversimplistic to simply say that all they're doing is changing the names of the Olympian gods. That's insulting. And I could understand if they see it that way. We all have our certain beliefs. And when we look at other people's beliefs, we do need to respect them and not look down upon them or necessarily say bad things about them simply because it's not something we believe ourselves. Just like, to be honest, I do believe that there are ghosts out there, and I've heard a bunch of ghost stories. I don't know if I believe them, but I do believe that there are things out there that we can't explain or that we don't understand. And so when it comes to other people's beliefs, show them respect and don't insult people because they believe in something that you don't. Online, there are places where people talk about the serious research into fairies. People do believe in fairies, and there's serious, direct scientific research being done into that area. And all of this, of course, comes down to, say, look, these Christian people who try and dismiss all this as nonsense and ignore it while they go on their merry ways, just because they ignore something, that does not mean that it does not have any relevance. I think that's where I'm going to go with that particular subject. And I do think it's interesting what people are doing now in the names of the Olympian gods and what people think is really important when you worship one of these gods. What is it that you do when you are showing your respect for this god? I might talk about that again some more when I am able to talk to some more of these people who do worship the Olympian gods or who do show their respect for the Olympian gods and why they show such honor to them. I believe that is how I will end this episode. As always, I thank you all for listening to the show. Also, if anyone has any ideas or things that you would like me to talk about, be sure to send me an email at folklorenow33@gmail.com. Hope you have a wonderful day, and I'll see you next time on Ballad-ish-ish Folklore Now.